Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we're recapping top diseases from this season of gardening and hopefully how to prevent them in the future. Our guest is Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. We call him Dr. Death. What would you like to know about controlling plant disease? What questions do you have about possible diseases on your plants? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email, and maybe if you've got a photo of a diseased plant, you can send that along too. Go send it to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Brian Huddleston, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me again.
Well, it's great to have you with us. What's the report on this season's hot diseases?
Well, lots of them. Because we've had COVID-19, I've been doing a lot more digital diagnostics, so a lot of photographs coming into the lab. So we're at record numbers of samples this year, and we've been seeing a lot of people having problems with what are technically called the gymnosporangium rust. So the big one that we typically see is something called cedar apple rust. So if you've been out taking a look at your apples, your crab apples, and have seen really big yellow or orange spots on the leaves, that's what you're dealing with. It's what's called an alternating rust. So the fungus spends part of its life cycle on things like apples and crab apples, sometimes hawthorns, and then the rest of its life cycle on junipers, particularly if you have red cedar growing in your area. That's an alternate host for this particular fungus that causes the disease. It's one of the more colorful diseases that I see in my business. So.
There you go. I think Richard in Lodi has one that you might be planning to talk about. Let's go there. Richard in Lodi, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good, appreciate your call.
Yeah, we planted some aspen trees about 2 to 3 years ago.
Okay.
We have three plantings of one tree each and one planting of a grouping of four. The grouping of four started losing its leaves early in the summer from the bottom up.
Okay.
With ink spots on it, and the rest, the other trees are good.
Okay. Did you see any evidence of any of the tips of the branches dying back, or was it just the leaf loss that you were seeing?
Well, the branches were dying off along with the leaf drop.
Okay. There are a couple of diseases that I tend to see on aspen. If it's something that occurred kind of earlier in the season, there's actually a disease that's related to apple scab, which is a very common fungal disease on apples and crab apples and pears. It's called Venturia leaf blight or shoot blight that occurs on aspen, and that will cause the tips to kind of turn black and will also cause black spots on the leaves. Slightly later in the season, I have been seeing some Septoria leaf spot. You may have heard that name Septoria bandied about with tomatoes. There is a Septoria disease on tomatoes that causes a defoliation from the bottom up, and this is a related fungus that can cause problems on aspen. Both of these are relatively cosmetic diseases. The main way that I tell folks to try to manage them is do really good fall cleanup of any of the leaves that come off the trees. And you want to get those away from the trees. You can burn that material if that's an option for you where you live. You can bury it to get a layer of soil that kind of traps any spores underground. Or if you're a good hot composter where you get your compost pile up to 140 degrees Fahrenheit, routinely turn it, you can also compost this material. With a venturi, you'd also have to prune out the dead branch tips. And with that, prune down about 4 to 6 inches below where you see dead tissue, and then be sure you're decontaminating your pruning tools between cuts. And we recommend things like 70% alcohol, so isopropyl or rubbing alcohol straight out of the bottle will work, and about a 30-second dip or treatment. If you don't have access to alcohol, you can also use 10% bleach, again, about a 30-second treatment, but make sure once you're done pruning that you rinse those tools really well and oil them. The bleach will actually promote rusting of the tools. You have to be a little careful with that.
Oh, there you go, Richard. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. So there's one issue. When I saw dark spots on leaves, I thought of another fungus or whatever that that hits many maple trees.
Yeah, tar spot.
Yeah.
Another big disease that we've been seeing a lot of, particularly late in the season, I think people are picking up on that as the leaves are changing color. And that fungus causes really large, probably about almost quarter size, black areas on the leaves, and they're very black and tarry looking. And we see that a lot, both on our native maples. There's one species of the fungus that goes to native maples like silver and red, and then another that came over from Europe that attacks Norway maple. So they're cosmetic diseases, though, again. Good fall cleanup, composting, good composting of those leaves. Or again, you can burn or bury them if you have those options. And those diseases, luckily, don't cause much damage to the trees.
Yeah. Jane in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Jane.
Good morning. I have a bunch of blueberry plants. They're, most of them are around 3 feet tall.
Okay.
I was wondering how to trim them and if it's too late in the year to fertilize them, or if I should put some acid on in the fall, or how to take care of them.
What I would suggest doing, I'm not that much of an expert on general blueberry care, but certainly they do need acidic soil conditions. Optimal, I think, is down around, well, maybe around 5 or so, maybe slightly more than that. So maybe 4.5. So you do need to monitor the soil pH and adjust that downward. And that can be very difficult in southern Wisconsin because our soil pHs are oftentimes very, very high. But I would do that based, any soil adjustment like that, based on a soil fertility test and pH test. And that can be done through our UW Soil and Forage Lab, which is up in Marshfield. They will take soil samples and do an analysis for you. I definitely would not fertilize at this time of the year. We run into problems if you fertilize too late. You can actually keep the plants from going dormant properly. And in terms of pruning, I'm on my computer right here, but I believe we have a publication through our Learning Store website called Growing Blueberries in Wisconsin. Let me just double check that while we're talking here. And if so, that would be a great, we don't have one on that particular topic, but again, I don't know enough about blueberries to tell you how to prune them properly, unfortunately.
But the soil test is really important, especially in the Watertown area. You're going to need to know. And when you get the soil test, you should tell them that you're growing blueberries. and they will tell you how much, what you need to do, what amounts you need to apply to acidify the soil. But it'll be a kind of an ongoing thing for you, Jane.
Yeah, the other option is to consider growing them in large pots. And we do have a fact sheet on growing blueberries in containers that's available. That's available in the fact sheet section of my clinic website. And that URL is P as in Paul, D as in David, D as in David again, C as in Charles, dot WISC. .edu. We have a lot of one-page fact sheets on my website in the fact sheet section, and that's one that's available. And sometimes you can get that adjustment of the soil pH much more under control if you're growing them in pots rather than growing them in native soil.
Yeah, there you go, Jane. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Michelle, in Arcadia, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Michelle.
Good morning. I'm having a problem with tomato blight.
Okay.
Last year, I moved my tomato plants out of my vegetable garden and into an area where I've traditionally grown flowers. Mm-hmm. And I had the most beautiful tomato crop I've ever had. So I put tomatoes in that area again this year, and they blighted.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's very typical. What happens is that, well, there are a variety of things that could potentially be going on, but you probably had a little bit of the disease even though you didn't necessarily notice it the first time you grew tomatoes in that new site. And if you did not get all of that old leaf debris, plant debris from your old batch of tomatoes cleaned up, then the fungus was there to help inoculate your new plants. And it's virtually impossible to totally collect up all plant debris out of an area. So moving your plants around from site to site can be very, very useful to a certain extent for the leaf blights. And again, the leaf blights I'm talking about are the ones that start at the bottom of the plant and work their way up. And the unfortunate part, though, about some of these fungi that cause these blights is that the spores are airborne, so they can be blown around. So even though you don't necessarily have infected debris or infected plants close to your new plants, the spores can blow to your plants, and if we have really wet conditions, then these diseases are going to be really, really bad. But moving plants around is really good. Really good spacing between plants is critical for controlling these diseases. So I always tell folks, as far apart as you can possibly get them, in the best of all possible worlds, when they're full grown, you don't want any overlap in branches on adjacent plants. You'll probably want to thin them some during the growing season to open up airflow. What all of this does with all of this airflow is that if the plants get wet, they dry really quickly. And you want dry plants, because if the plants stay wet, these fungi go to town. So other things, mulch underneath the plants. That way, if you've missed some of that debris, you've got a physical barrier there that prevents the spores from getting out of that debris and onto your new plants. And then no overhead watering when you can avoid it. Now, Mother Nature overhead waters, we can't stop that. But if you're supplemental watering, use a soaker hose or a drip hose. And if you're absolutely desperate, there are fungicide treatments that you could use. But at that point, for home gardeners, I usually tell folks to go to your farmer's market and buy some tomatoes. It's a real hassle to have to spray, quite frankly.
Yeah, it is indeed. Michelle, thank you so much. Steve in Boulder Junction emailed wondering if you know, is the definition for fungus and viruses the same for plants as it is for humans? Do they mean the same thing in flora and fauna?
Yeah, basically, yes. I mean, there are some differences in terms of when you look at viruses, some of the structures with some of the plant viruses can be different from some of the animal viruses, but they're basically the same sorts of organisms, and they're all classified together in a large group. Fungi are basically the same across all organisms as well. So, yeah, that's a great question. Very yeah. biological, but very, 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 very good question. So, and then kind of as a follow-up, people will often ask me, okay, so if these fungi are the same on animals and plants, you know, the ones that are infecting my plants, are they going to infect me? And that's relatively rare. There are very few fungal organisms that will infect both plants and humans. And usually the fungi involved are kind of wimpy pathogens on both groups of organisms. So they're not really great plant pathogens. They're really not that great of a human pathogen. And typically for humans, it's oftentimes someone who's immunocompromised that's going to have more of a problem with those sorts of organisms. So
there we go. Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, our guest today. Jane Rotunda, our producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at plant diseases, we're kind of getting a little recap of the year with our guest today, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic. Great to have him back, Larry Mueller here. Lots of callers online, Brian, so I think we'll go back to the phones. Jill and Racine, you're next. Hi, Jill. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Brian and Larry. I'll say it again. Larry, I love your program. Anyway... You had just said not to plant. Tomorrow we're having two blue angel white pines planted and two barberry bushes planted. Are we still okay?
Yes, I think at this, it's getting a little late in the season to do that, but it's been warm enough. I think you'll probably be okay. The main thing we worry about with planting in the fall is that you need to give the plants a little bit of time to get some new root production. It'll help stabilize them in the soil, help them survive the wintertime. Definitely when you're putting in materials, you want to, if it's an evergreen sort of shrub, you want to give those plenty of water as we continue into the fall. So about 2 inches of water per week, all the way up until the point where either the ground freezes or we get a significant snowfall. If the trees are a deciduous tree and they're dormant, they've lost their leaves, you won't necessarily have to water. But definitely with evergreens, I recommend that continued water. And you're going to have to do a lot of watering for the next probably 2 to 3 years thereafter. And that'll start when the trees or shrubs begin to bud out in the spring. And then, again, that 2 inches of water per week, either from natural rain or through you adding water with a drip or soaker hose, and continue that, again, all the way into the fall with deciduous plants that drop their leaves. I tell folks to water all the way up until they start to turn their normal fall color. And then, again, the evergreens later than that, all the way until the ground freezes. It's very important to give them that water because that's probably the biggest reason why transplants fail is that they're not watered enough. And in fact, I've seen so many photos this year. I think the nice thing about getting a lot of photos coming into my lab is that I get pictures of entire plants rather than just seeing branches or roots that I typically get in my clinic. And it gives me a real sense of how poorly a lot of plants are planted. And I was so upset about that, I try to write a monthly web article. And my web article for September was on all of the planting issues that I'd seen over the course of the summer.
Yeah, it's hard sometimes to drive around and you look at some of those plantings and you say, oh, no, those are, you know, that's just not going to work.
Yeah. One of the big things we have problems with is when you get buy materials, oftentimes they're bald and burlapped, and people will leave the burlap on. There's a wire basket underneath there. They'll leave that on. Sometimes they'll even leave twine or wires around the trunk, and all of those can potentially cause problems down the road if they're not removed.
Let's take another call. Jill, thanks again. Appreciate it. Julia in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Julia.
Hello. Nice to talk to you. I just want to say hello to Tyler Ditter, too, real quick, your engineer, because I play in a band with him. But
cool.
Thanks for taking my call. I am struggling with powdery mildew all over my lilac bushes, and it's bred to this Virginia creeper, which I've just been, like, lazy about yanking out. But I'm just worried that it's harming the lilac bush, and I was wondering if there's a way to get rid of the cursed powdery mildew.
My main recommendation, particularly when you see powdery mildew on lilacs, is develop a really good ability to totally ignore it. This is a cosmetic disease, particularly on lilacs and on most plants. Quite frankly, powdery mildews tend to be pretty cosmetic. There are some exceptions, but certainly on most, virtually all woody ornamentals like lilacs, the plants get powdery mildew, and it doesn't affect them at all. They could care less. So I call lilac the poster child for powdery mildew that has no effect at all or very little. So I'll learn to ignore it. It's not going to harm your plant. And just a comment, you mentioned spread to your Virginia creeper. It's probably not the same fungus. There are lots and lots and lots of different powdery mildew fungi. They tend to be relatively host specific. So whenever you're seeing powdery mildews, you may see it on a lot of plants, but it's not exactly the same organism. Just tells you that the environment is pretty humid. Powdery mildew fungi in general like really, really humid conditions. So go have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea. Don't worry about those lilacs.
There you go, Julia. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Rick and Holman, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, good morning. 5 years ago, I bought a bunch of Zone 4 Concord grapes.
Okay.
And I've tried every way possible to get grapes out of those dang things. I've cut them off at the bottom. I've never left the canes on the wires. I'm at a loss. I haven't had grapes since the first year.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm not the best person to talk about grapes. Where are you located again?
Holman.
Holman, okay.
Wisconsin.
Yeah. Trying to think of the best place to send you initially would be to... I'm going to refer you to a publication, again, that's at our Learning Store website. And
training systems for cold climate grapes? Is that the one you were thinking?
I was thinking just growing grapes in Wisconsin. I think that's a great starting publication. So if you go to learningstore.extension.wisc.edu and then just do a search on growing grapes in Wisconsin, and that will have pointers for you on how to care for and take and try to get good production of on your grape plants. And I deal with the diseases on there, but it sounds like you have more fundamental problems with the plants than just diseases.
And that's a great publication. There is another one while you're there at the UW Learning Store site, that training system for cold climate grapes is also another one you might want to just grab while you're there, Rick. And if you just type in UW Extension Learning Store, it's probably going to pop up.
That should pop up as well. And then the other person I'm going to connect you with is, you're in La Crosse County, so I'm going to connect you with Kathy Davis. She is the agriculture and horticulture educator in La Crosse County. So if you look up UW Extension La Crosse County, and you should be able to find their number. And I would tap into her expertise as well.
She may have something about that particular area that could be useful for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rick, thank you so much for calling. You can join in as well with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Rod in Blairhauser, is that correct? Rod?
Weyerhaeuser.
That, I thought that might be it, but I wasn't. I thought, well, maybe there's a new name out there I didn't know. Okay. What's on your mind?
Well, that's named after Frederick Weyerhaeuser, the lumber baron.
Yep.
City Hall. I planted 3 plum trees, and I was a little bit late on the draw to put up the white tubing.
Okay.
I got tubing around them now. I wish you'd sell the trees with that on there, you know. But anyhow, I planted all 3 of them. I got 3 different kinds. Well, the one that's furthest from the house, sure as heck, I don't know if it was my cats or deer, but they peeled the bark off about 1.5 feet high, but it didn't quite go all the way around. So I'm thinking, well, maybe it'll make it. But they said that black stuff that you used to put on where bark was off, I told 3 of your people now told me, don't put that on there.
Yeah.
So I just put that tubing around it.
Yeah. You're probably going to have a challenge getting that tree to survive with that much of the bark removed, because that right underneath that bark is all of the water conducting tissue to get the water from the roots up into the branches. And if you don't have much of that bark left, then you're not going to get much water moving up into the plant. So don't be surprised if that tree does not survive the winter. So you may have to replace that particular tree. With the white tubing, I normally recommend a very limited use of that. I think it's great at certain times of the year, particularly as we go into winter, to protect the trunks. But you don't want to leave that on too long, because it can do a couple of things. One, it can trap a lot of moisture, and then that can make the trunks more prone to being infected by certain types of fungi. And then the other thing we have seen, oftentimes new transplants are growing pretty rapidly, and the trunks will actually get large enough that that white material will start to girdle them. So you need to be careful about that as well. And then your comment about the pruning paints, yes, we do not recommend those anymore. It actually appears, based on current research, to slow down normal healing of the trees. So when they're injured, they produce what's called callus tissue to try to close over that wound. And the paints appear to slow up that process. So the only time we really recommend painting when you're wounding a tree is if you are forced to prune an oak tree during the growing season, when it's actively growing. We do recommend immediately painting over the wound, and that's to prevent transmission of the oak wilt fungus. And that painting needs to be done, like, immediately. There's research that indicates that sap beetles, which will carry the oak wilt fungus, will visit a wound within about 10 minutes of the wound forming. So you need to get that paint on right away. But you don't necessarily have to use the commercial paint. If you've got leftover something like latex paint from painting your house, you can use that over the wounds. You just need a physical barrier to keep the insects out.
All right. There you go, Rod. Thank you so much for calling. Well, Al in Westby, what's on your mind?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Larry. Several years ago, when tobacco production ended in Vernon County, Dean County, and there was a buyout, farmers were looking for another cash crop, and they began growing grapes, and they had educational programs put on by UW Extension and other groups. So the person in Holman, if they could contact, here I'm looking online, www.wigrapes.org is the Wisconsin Grape Growers Association. And I wondered if Brian could quickly go over prepping ground for, I've got two Norway spruce to plant and really root-bound white lilac bush. And how aggressive can you get tearing those root balls apart? So I don't want to hurt the roots, but I don't want those things girdling in 2 or 3 years either.
Yeah.
That's a great program, Larry.
Thank you, Al.
Yeah, if the plants are really root-bound, I would probably personally be pretty aggressive. You run the risk of doing so much injury that, you know, the plant may not survive the planting process. But on the other hand, if they're really root-bound and you've got a lot of roots that are circling around the crown of that shrub, or if it's a tree lilac around the trunk, you run the risk that over time those will girdle the trunk or girdle the crown, and then you're going to lose the shrub anyway. So I would be relatively aggressive to try to break up a lot of that root. You know, be gentle with it. Try not to do a lot of physical injury if you can prevent it. But do get those roots separated and kind of spread out. And definitely if you see roots that are growing around the crown or around the trunk, if you can't get those situated so that they're growing outward from the crown or trunk, then you may want to consider clipping some of those off. But you want to deal with those sorts of problems at planting so that they don't linger and cause issues later on. And then just make sure you're doing digging a large enough hole. Normally, recommendation is about 3 times the diameter of the root mass that you're going to be planting. And it doesn't have to be uniformly deep, but you definitely want a large area so that, again, you can kind of situate roots and get them projecting outward from the main trunk or main crown, and then definitely make sure, particularly if it's a tree, but also with shrubs as well, that what's called the root flare is visible right above the soil line. So that's the area where the trunk kind of widens to form the root system, that you do not want to bury that. It tends to stress the tree or shrub, and also you can get formation of girdling roots after the fact if you have things buried too deeply. Fill in with native soil. Don't add a different type of soil mix. I had a situation with a client that they'd used radically different soils to fill in the holes compared to what they were growing the plants in, and that's going to cause some problems later on. So kind of keep the soil uniform, and then just really good watering like we described before.
Yeah, there you go, Al. Thank you so much. Appreciate the call. Carrie in Erin, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Carrie.
Hello. Question. I just purchased a couple of small plants, a male and a female, of American bittersweet.
Okay.
And I planted them, but I read about it. It needs a tree to climb. Is there any precaution? I mean, I just did this last week for as far as the frost. Should I mulch it? And then just listening to your last comment, does the root ball need to be at a certain level of soil?
Yeah, again, with any plant that you're planting that's a woody ornamental, I would kind of look for, again, what's called the root flare. It may not be very visible on a vine like American bittersweet, but if you see any sort of widening of that vine as the roots start to come out, you kind of want that situated around right above the soil line. Mulching is never a bad idea. That's something I haven't talked about before, but once you plant trees and shrubs, we do recommend mulching. How much you mulch depends upon the soil type. So roughly about 1 to 2 inches of mulch if you have a heavier clay soil, and then 3, maybe up to 4 inches if you have a really, really sandy soil. And keep that material about 4 inches to 6 inches away from the trunk, because you don't want that mulch up onto the trunk or the bottom of the shrub or vine. that can keep conditions overly wet and then makes the plants more prone to infections, again, by fungi. So, and you wouldn't necessarily have to have it growing up a tree. It could be growing up a trellis. It could be growing up a fence. But I love American bittersweet. That's a really cool plant.
Yeah, it is indeed. Carrie, thank you so much. Good luck. Appreciate it.
But you've got to be careful not to grow the Asiatic species. Those are invasive. So be careful when you're buying those plants that you get the American species.
Kelly in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Brian. I have another lilac question.
Okay.
My lilacs are about 25 years old, and this year, for the first time ever, they dropped all their leaves in the middle of summer and then started resprouting, never to really come back again. What was going on?
Yeah, I wrote my August web article on that disease and some other lilac diseases. What you're probably seeing is another, we've talked about Septoria diseases. I talked about it on tomatoes. I talked about it on aspen earlier on. It's probably another Septoria disease. There are lots and lots of Septoria fungi out there, and we have been seeing one on lilac this year. And I think the reason it's been so bad this year is that 2018 and 19 were pretty wet years. We had a pretty wet early part of the growing season this year, and so we've had a lot of time for this Septoria fungus to build up to high levels. And I've been seeing defoliation on lilacs all over the state. And again, it's that bottom-up sort of loss to the leaves, and if it occurred early enough in the growing season, it doesn't surprise me at all that the shrubs try to leaf out again. That's a very typical response when you get defoliation. I would just check the branches. If everything is going okay, you should be able to see buds ready to sprout out next year, already on those branches, and you should be good to go. The leaves may be slightly smaller than normal next year. The plants may not grow as much next year, but I would not expect this sort of leaf disease to kill the plant. What you do need to do, though, is definitely clean up all of the leaf debris from around those shrubs. That's where the fungus is going to hang out over the winter. And in the spring, when it gets wet, it's going to generate spores, and those will be able to reinfect the new leaves. And then the other thing, if you have not been doing kind of renewal thinning on your lilacs, which you should do every few years, then I would consider doing that. That's going to open up the canopy on the plant, and that's going to dry things out, which is going to be less favorable for this sort of disease.
That's an old plant. If you haven't done any pruning, I mean, you should, what do we do, the third business,
yep,
where you take a third, the biggest ones, the biggest branches, right down to the ground.
Right.
Get rid of them.
Yep. And you want to do that routinely to keep the canopy relatively open. And that'll also stimulate new canes to be produced. And those tend to be a little bit better for flower production as well.
Yep, for sure. It's interesting because Tana in Monroe and Mary in Rhinelander had the same observation about the suddenly lilacs are blooming after they didn't or they quit blooming earlier in the year.
Yep.
And so it's kind of, and you've seen it quite a bit yourself this year, so.
You're in countdown for diseases.
Oh, we're losing you, Brian. So, Brian Huddleston, our guest today, he's having a little problems with power on his phone, I think. That may be the issue. We'll see. Brian, of course, the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison out of the Department of Plant Pathology. Always great to have him come by to talk plant diseases, and we've taken a few other questions as well. Questions, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take another call. Kevin in Madison will give you a chance now. Hi, Kevin. Oops, sorry. Sean in Egg Harbor. Let's go there. Hi, Sean.
Sorry, this isn't Sean.
Oh, is this Kevin?
No, sorry.
Oh, okay. Well, you're having a little noise issue with your phone there. I'm not sure who we were talking with. Sean in Egg Harbor?
I'm sorry.
Oh, we lost.
Did we lose him?
Hello.
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 Hi. Hi. Who are we speaking with?
Hi, Larry. This is Sean from Egg Harbor.
Oh, okay. Well, now we've got you on. We had an interloper there for a minute.
Yeah.
Sean, when I tried to get you in.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. And I have a follow-up question to an earlier caller about the planting trees and shrubs method.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
We had six Black Hills spruce planted in 2017. They mm-hmm. were like eight, they were 6 or 7 footers at the time. And they were planted by a landscaping company. And they were bald and burlapped, and they had the big wire basket around them.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time they planted them, they did not cut the basket or the burlap off. And I even asked them at the time, I asked them, and they said, no, no, we never do that. The roots will just grow, you know, they'll just push out through. And they planted them kind of high, you know, so I can kind of see the crown, you know, a little bit above the ground. And at the time I was told, you know, too high, never die, too low, never grow. And I have watered them, you know, really pretty well. They actually were planted in August of 17, and it was really hot and dry. It was probably not the best time to plant them. But for the most part, they're doing okay. But I'm just worried that I might see plants or problems in the future because they're in the ground like that. And then, and what can I do now? Or is it too late?
Yeah, it's, you know, it might be worthwhile experimenting with one of the trees and digging it up to see what it's done. It's really very unfortunate that they did not remove the burlap and the wire basket. The burlap in particular, a lot of folks will claim that, yes, that will rot away, but we've seen situations where, you know, 10 years down the road, the burlap is still there. And what that can do is restrict root growth, and the roots may not necessarily grow through the burlap. What they may do is circle the tree, and then you end up with girdling roots. And the wire baskets can cause problems with girdling roots as well. So you might want to experiment with one of the trees, kind of dig it up gently or dig down and see what you're seeing, if there's any way to remove any of the burlap, which I think is going to be pretty impossible at this point. But mm-hmm. that's just very unfortunate that they planted that that way.
They, you know, they've probably grown 4 feet
okay.
in height
mm-hmm.
since then.
It's usually about 5 years out.
Yeah.
It's 5 years out.
Yeah, then you start. We'll start to see problems if
really?
There are issues. Yeah. Well, the saving grace for you, if it ends up that you have to replace those trees, is I would not recommend planting Black Hill spruce anymore.
Oh, okay.
That particular tree has serious problems anymore with a fungal disease called Rhizosphera needle cast, and it will cause loss of interior needles in the canopy, and you'll end up with a lot of relatively bare branches. We used to see that more on blue spruce, but at one time we were kind of recommending Black Hill spruce because it seemed to be pretty resistant. But nowadays we're seeing more problems on that particular kind of tree. So you may end up, for disease reasons, wanting to replace those trees eventually anyway.
And I would not allow anybody to plant new trees with that burlap and wire around.
Yes.
That, it's hard to imagine that an actual company would.
That's not that unusual, Larry, actually. I get a lot of flack. I know Laura Joel, my colleague in the horticulture department, who really advocates removing burlap and wire baskets, gets a lot of flack from certain people about recommending that. They don't think it's necessary, and there's quite a bit of research indicating that it's best to take off that material. The other thing I would do whenever you get bald and burlap materials again is make sure you kind of gently remove the soil from the top of the ball. Lots of times the root flare that I talked about earlier will be buried, and so you want to expose that. And sometimes if you put the top of that root ball at the soil line, you still have the tree planted too deeply because the root flare was buried in the nursery.
Yeah. Sean, there you go. Sorry for that news. But,
yeah,
but you know,
that.
You could experiment, you know, on one tree. Why not give it a try and just see what happens?
No, but I do have needles on the interior of the tree. I mean, there's a lot of needles on the ground underneath because I'm still watering them pretty regularly. But I am getting a lot of needle drop on the interiors.
Yeah. What I would suggest that you do, Sean, is email me. And my email is PDDC, so short for Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, at WISC, WISC.edu. And this is for you, the rest of your listeners as well. I do have a listing of conifers that Laura Joel put together about 3 or 4 years ago. We did a tag team set of talks. I talked about conifer diseases, and she talked about better conifers to be planting, and I'm happy to share that with you if you'd like a copy of that.
All right. There you go. Sean, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Well, Janice in Grafton, it's your turn. Hi, Janice.
Hi. I'm calling up. I missed some of this. I had a phone call and something. The soil pH for blueberries, you mentioned that, and where do I call to get the number if possible, and where to send my sample?
Yeah, that would be the UW Soil and Forage Lab. Are you hooked up onto the internet?
Well, yes, I'm not on it right now, but okay.
Do a search on UW Soil and Forage Lab, and they should be able to link you up. Or you'll get a link to their website.
Yeah, and all of the information about how to take the sample and all that is in there. And then again, be sure to mention that you're planting or you have blueberries in that area, and you'll get the recommendations. And not too expensive either.
No, probably about between $20 and $30 to do an analysis.
Yeah. And well worth it if you're,
yes.
Especially for blueberries, but for other things as well.
Yeah, and I do recommend periodically, you know, every 3 years or so, just do a soil test to see where you are in terms of your kind of base nutrients in an area and see whether you need to fertilize or not.
Thank you again, Janice. Appreciate it. Let's go to Jan in Madison. Hi, Jan.
Hello there. I have a mystery. My hardy rhubarb plant has its leaves turning bright red, starting on the outer part of the leaves and going to the inner part. So I want to know, what is it and what's the treatment, if any?
And did that happen during the growing season, or is it just turning color now?
It's just turning color now, and I haven't noticed that happening before.
It may simply be turning its normal fall color for the leaves to go dormant, for the plant to go dormant for this season. What I would do would be to continue to monitor that in the spring. If it starts doing that with that kind of red margin during the growing season, when it's actively growing, I worry a little bit about root rot problems. That's probably the biggest issue disease-wise that I see on rhubarb. You get fungi or related organisms that get into the roots and rot them, and then the plants can't take up nutrients or water particularly efficiently. And then you'll end up, they'll show what basically look like nutrient deficiency symptoms. So I would hold off. If you see that next year, give me a shout.
All right. Good luck, Jan. Thank you. Sally in Delavan, your turn. Hi, Sally.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What can we do for you?
Well, we have the strangest thing. It's not a black walnut tree. It's a butternut tree that has nothing on it this year. There is not one single butternut on our tree.
Yeah, that sounds like a pollination issue of some kind. And if there was, you know, that can be caused by a variety of different things. Sometimes if it can be, if it was a really hot at the period when it was flowering, probably not an issue, but sometimes that can kill the pollen. Sometimes if there's a lot of rain during the period when it's pollinating, you just don't get movement of the pollen. It all gets washed away rather than it, you know, blowing around and fertilizing. Those are the two things that I can think of. I don't think it's probably a disease problem. It's probably just an issue. For some reason, the trees didn't pollinate.
Yeah, it, I would watch it next year.
Yeah. And did it fruit really heavily 2 summers ago?
Yes. Every year it produces grapefruit.
Okay.
Every year.
Okay. And so it's consistent. It's just been this year. The leaves look fine on the tree?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. I just think it's an anomaly with the pollination. And like Larry said, I would just watch it next year. I suspect it may come back and do very well and produce fruit next year.
There you go, Sally. Keep an eye on it. Thank you for calling. Sean in Lake Halley, your turn. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how are you? Hello.
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Puffball mushrooms. I didn't know if there was anything I could do with them in my yard. And I think I might have another fungus in there. I noticed in the summer that it was getting giant brown patches in it, but the puffballs weren't really growing out where the brown patches were. And I didn't know if there was anything that could be done.
This is in your lawn?
Correct.
Yeah. The puffballs, usually when I have folks that ask me about mushrooms and lawns, my typical recommendation is just as you see those, just go and pluck them out. That's about the only thing that you can do. There are no chemical treatments that you can use for that. And usually what's going on, there's some probably mass of organic matter that's buried somewhere in that vicinity of where you're seeing the mushrooms, and that's what the mushrooms are growing on. So most of what you're seeing is actually underground and kind of growing through that organic matter. The mushroom that you're seeing is basically just a reproductive structure. So until that mass of organic matter is gone, those mushrooms are going to continue to come. And how many you see will depend upon how wet it is. So there's not a lot I can recommend that's an easy fix for that. I would just go out and pluck them out whenever you see them.
And the lawn itself, you said there were some circular spots on the lawn that were dead, or?
And everything else around it was nice and green.
Yeah, the fungi can do that. Sometimes what they'll do, the fungal threads will mat, and then they prevent water from getting down into the roots of the grass in that area. What you can go through is kind of aerate that area, and oftentimes that'll get the grass to regenerate. So there are attachments you can get for your lawnmower to do that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I did dethatch it here. That's when I noticed them too, right after I dethatched it. So
yeah. Again, I would continue to do that because, again, they're going to be feeding on that organic matter. And if you dethatch it, keep it well aerated, I think you'll reduce problems with that. But, again, I still think you're going to see mushrooms. Until whatever that underlying organic matter is that they're living on goes away, they're going to continue to sprout the mushrooms.
Thank you, Sean, for calling. Well, Glenn Stanos from Middleton on with us. He's a tree guy. Glenn, hey. Hi.
Hi, Glenn.
Yeah, hi. Very good to hear the voice of my favorite diagnostic clinic director there. I kind of miss our hallway talks. But I'm calling because I'd like to refer people to the planting specifications of the International Society of Arboriculture.
Yep.
I, too, have run into situations where alleged experts from nurseries and landscape companies plop trees into the ground, not removing the twine or burlap around the base or the baskets. So just very quickly, there are good planting specifications that should be followed. And if people want to Google this, they could just Google ISA planting spec.
Yep.
ISA planting spec. And then the first thing that comes up on my computer anyway is a link to planting details and specifications. And there's a whole bunch of drawings, and they even go into how to plant in different soil, heavily compacted soil, sandy soil. But not a one of the specifications shows leaving the basket and leaving the burlap and leaving the twine tied around the base of the tree.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Glenn, thank you so much for calling in with that. I appreciate it very much, Glenn Stanos. But our guest today, Brian Huddleston, is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. To have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. With us today, Brian Huddleston, the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. He's works out of the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. So what plant disease questions do you have? What other gardening questions are on your mind? Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. We'd certainly love to hear from you. You know, you've stressed, Brian, the importance of fall cleanup, and that really is important.
Definitely, because most of the disease-causing organisms that we routinely encounter, they're surviving in that old leaf litter. So anything you can do to remove that is very, very important. And with things like perennials, you know, cutting those back and getting rid of the tops of the plants can be important as well to get rid of a source of pathogens. Now, some people like to leave it because they want some winter interest in their gardens. And also some of that material can be a place where some of our native insects, pollinators, can overwinter. So some people prefer to try to do the cleanup in the spring, which is fine, but my caution with that is just make sure you get rid of that material before the plants start to sprout.
Yeah, I'm one of those who likes to keep that winter interest, at least in my flowers in the front. And so far, I've been lucky. I guess I've had pretty good results every year, but I do a pretty good cleanup in the spring, for sure.
Yeah, well, you can do what I do, is not clean up at all, because I like the diseases, so I leave the stuff around, and then I've got plenty of material to use as teaching material for my classes. So if
you
need diseases, you can contact me. I can probably supply quite a few things that you might be of interest.
All right. On that note, let's go to Deborah in Brown Deer. Hi, Deborah.
Hello, you guys.
Hi.
This is a great show. I live
you.
In Brown Deer. You're welcome. I have two. We have like a rosy glow barberry plant in the front yard, but in the backyard, there's two. And one is like the original variety, which I think is vulgaris. But I was gone for 4 months. And when I came back, it was dead. And I am the homeowner said he has no idea. And that to me means, I'm sorry. I don't know if he put like, because I had planted a Sangukaku Japanese maple, which is a coral bark maple back there. And I told him where it was, and I'm thinking he sprayed something on that. But I've never seen a dead barberry bush, and I wondered if you have any ideas.
This is Japanese barberry that you're talking about?
I'm not sure. I that was planted over 20 years ago.
Yeah. There's a silver lining in that plant dying. It could have been taken out by crown rot. I do see crown rots cause problems in Japanese barberry. And that those will come in through the roots and then kind of decay away the root system and the crown of the plant, and that can kill it. A lot of the Japanese barberries are considered invasive species nowadays, so the fact that that plant died is not necessarily a bad thing, because that reduces the number of invasive plants that we have around, and it gives you an opportunity to replace it with something that maybe is a little better and less invasive. So I try to think of that as a silver lining in this particular case.
All right, Deborah, thank you for calling. Rod in, I think in Weyerhaeuser, I'm guessing. Yeah. It says, yeah, okay.
Sorry, Larry, I was going to ask another question. I forgot when I called about the plum trees. On the Goodland, my apple tree that I planted, the Goodland, a real good apple, it's about 5-inch diameter. Should I cut them suckers off at right at ground level?
Yes, I would remove those. They're probably, that probably indicates that the tree was planted a little bit too deeply when it was originally planted, and you may be getting sprouting off of the rootstock. Oftentimes, apple trees, the top of the tree is actually grafted on to a more stable, more winter-hardy rootstock, and so you want to get rid of those sprouts. Do not spray them, though. Do not spray them with an herbicide. You want to clip those out.
Clip them, for sure.
Yeah.
There you go, Rod. Thank you so much for calling back again. I'm sorry we missed out on that second question earlier. Ernestina in Eau Claire, what's on your mind?
Good afternoon. I would like to transfer some irises from my house to my daughter's house. I can dig them up now, but I probably won't be able to put them in the ground for her until spring. How can I, one, keep them, and two, transport them?
Yeah.
And you want to do it now?
I need to do it now.
Okay.
Yeah, that. Do you know that answer? Because I certainly can't answer that question, Larry. I'm sorry.
I'm reluctant to, you know, it's, I guess you could try to overwinter the bulbs in a sort of a medium where you kind of keep them in a barely damp soil over winter. You could try that and see if it works. Somebody else is probably saying, Larry, what are you talking about? And they'll call quickly and tell me, but I think you could keep them that way. Let's hear what others have to say. And it's irises, right? So they're bulbs, so you should be able to save those bulbs until next year. So we'll wait and see if we get some other information from somebody. Chuck in Sterling, it's your turn. Hi, Chuck.
Good afternoon, guys. I bought a property about 4 years ago, and there were some evergreens planted in the back. And it looked like, somebody had bought a bunch of them, put them in the ground about a foot apart, and then never got around to transplanting them. And now I've got a pine that's got a little 4 to 5 inch thick or diameter trunk and 25 feet high. And there's another one about that size, and then the rest of them are like a half inch to an inch or two. What should I do? Should I just thin all the small ones out and let the bigger ones grow, or should I just leave it survival of the fittest?
So I would be inclined to thin, quite frankly, because it sounds like they were originally put in way too close together. And if you've got something that dense, do you know if it's a pine, is it arborvitae, or is it just an evergreen of some kind?
There's a couple of long-needled pines, white,
okay.
I think, and then there's some spruce.
Oh, the spruce.
You know, there's about 15 of them in a 10-by-5-foot area.
Yeah, that's way too dense, and you're going to run into a lot of disease problems if you don't thin it. So I would be inclined to really thin those down. You may only want to retain maybe one or two of those trees in that area and concentrate on the ones that look healthiest and are growing most vigorously. and that'll reduce competition, which will help the trees that remain, and also you're going to open things up, get a little drier, so it's less favorable for diseases to develop as well. And the spruces, again, I mentioned earlier some of the needle problems that we have on spruces. Keeping things dry and open will help prevent some of those needle diseases.
And thank you very much for calling. You know, I was thinking about those irises. If you, I think the bulbs just need to be put, take the bulbs and store them in a cool, dry place. I wouldn't put them in soil. Wait a minute. Here's Patty in Eden has an answer. So let's go there and see if I was right. Hi, Patty.
Oh, yes, you are right, Larry. I'm a master gardener from Beaumont County, and we have no problem digging up an iris any time of the year. They're so tough. They don't die. And the main thing you'd have to look for, though, if you're sharing them, is they get these iris borers that infiltrate the corms, and you should cut that part away. And you can throw them in a bucket with some compost and drainage and keep them outdoors for any number of months, and they'll be fine to transplant.
Okay. Well, all right. I'm glad to have my second comment verified by Patty. Thank you so much, Patty. Appreciate it. Good to have Master Gardeners listening in, isn't it?
Definitely.
Oh, man. Susie and Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Susie.
Well, I wanted to comment about the irises, too. And thank you, Larry. You always have good programs. Years back, I was digging up irises, and I just threw them, you know, just threw them in a pile of junk in our backyard. And the next spring, there was something growing, and sure enough, it was irises. So I just drew them, you know, it was kind of a compost pile, but not really. And, you know, one of those things. So I just dug them out and planted them, and they were real tough. So anyhow, here's my, really, I don't know if you can kill them. Well, maybe, but here's my question. So a year ago this past spring, we had the most beautiful burning bush planted next to our house. I was so proud of it. And my husband and I are winter Texans. So last winter, we went to Texas and came back in March. And, gee, I looked at the bush, and here all the bark was off of it. So are you still there?
Oh, yeah.
So all the bark was off of it. And this is a beautiful bush. So I just let it be for a little bit. And when the real spring started to come through, I took a really, really close look at this bush, and it was green down by the ground. So I cut it back to about 3 inches. And have nursed it and nursed it and nursed it. And now it's a nice little bush. So I want to put a cone on it to protect it this winter. When do I do that?
Yeah, we usually oftentimes don't recommend putting cones on shrubs to protect them. What you might want to try doing is wait towards very close to when we start to get, looks like the ground is going to freeze, and then mulch around the base of the shrub to insulate it that way. What we tend to find with cones, oftentimes it traps too much moisture, and mm-hmm. that will actually make the environment more favorable for certain diseases to get established. So most of the time we're not really big on using cones like that. But if you're going to mulch up like that, then as soon as it starts to warm up in the spring, I would remove that. You want to get that away from the crown because, again, you don't want to trap too much moisture around the crown of the shrub.
Right. But how do I protect them from the animals?
Oh, the animals I would put up, I would be inclined to put fencing around to keep them away rather than a cone.
Yeah. Yeah, you're better off with a fence.
Fence.
Unfortunately,
okay.
Susie, got a little work to do there. Thank you for calling, though. Mary in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I have a question about what happens to trees when bark mulch is put around them and the mulch is in contact with the tree instead of being pulled back so there's some space for the tree bark to breathe. So I see that a lot done by individuals and contractors and major landscapers. And so it's a case where you don't see the root flare at all and there's no space between between the tree and the bark. So what kinds of things happen to the tree then?
Yeah, the major thing that I worry about from a disease standpoint is that mulch will trap moisture along the bark, and those wet conditions are going to be fungi out in the environment that potentially could infect through the bark and cause an infection in the main trunk, which will eventually girdle the tree, and then that could cause the entire tree to die back. The other issue that we sometimes find is that we get small animals, mice, voles, other things that will find that if it's there in the wintertime, a nice place to nest, and then they could potentially gnaw at the bark as well and cause some damage that way. So those are a couple of things potentially that could be an issue. And we do have a lot of problems with what we call mulch volcanoes, where people will pile huge piles of mulch along the trunk of the tree. And I tell folks just get out there and remove that. And, again, try to keep it back about 4 to 6 inches away from the main trunk.
Yep. There you go. Thank you, Mary. Dave in Broadhead, your turn now. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Larry. I have a question. I have several lilac trees, and I mean they're big. They're 15 feet tall kind of thing. And in there invariably we also have lots of mulberry trees and box elders and stuff, and I find them growing in the lilac tree, and I try and cut them off. What I'm wondering is, if I see them out like in fence lines and stuff, I put Tordon or something on them to keep them from coming back. If I do that where I cut them off in the lilacs, is that going to go down to the roots and possibly kill the lilacs?
As far as I'm aware, I don't know of any root grafting that would occur between those particular species. So my first thought is that you probably should be safe to do that, but I'd rather that you would talk to one of our, you know, herbicide specialists about that. So what county are you in?
I'm sorry.
No, I'm in Green. I'm actually in Green County.
You're in Green County. I would give their office, the extension office there, a call and ask them to get a hold of one of the weed specialists with that particular question, because I think you're probably going to be safe, but I just want to make sure that there's no possibility that you could get transfer of that herbicide into your lilacs. That would be a real shame if that would happen.
Yeah.
And sometimes these materials work in weird ways that I'm not aware of, so I think it's best to get in contact with one of the herbicide or weed specialists with that particular question.
All right. There you go, Dave. Thank you. Mike in Winona, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. I have a 6 or 7 year old blue spruce, about 2.5 feet tall. I'd like to transplant it in Duluth, and I wonder if this fall, if it's too late, or if I should wait till spring.
I would wait till spring on that one, particularly how far far north you are if you're taking it up to Duluth. I think you'll probably get better survival if you do it in the spring. But again, if you're going to transplant it, get as big a root mass as you possibly can to preserve as much of the root system on that tree, because you're going to be pruning off a fair amount of the root system when you dig it up. And then I talked about watering before. You really need to make sure you're giving that transplant enough water.
All right, there you go. Thank you so much. Mary from Wanakee, I think, emailed. Well, actually, no, she's not Wanakee. She's in Buffalo County. Their farm in Buffalo County seems to attract every new invasive species there is. Buckthorn, honeysuckle, autumn olive, Japanese barberry are the worst. Is there any research, she wonders, directed to developing diseases to control the spread of these species outside of their native ranges?
There has been some work, not necessarily with these species, but for weed control with disease-causing organisms. Oftentimes, the downside to trying to do that is, again, oftentimes when we do this sort of thing for any sort of control, there are unexpected consequences, and so the pathogens that we think, you know, are directed towards these weed species for some reason may have a wider host range than what we expect, and so we end up causing problems on other plants that weren't originally targeted for the diseases. So that tends to be a little bit of a dicey sort of prospect. Certainly people are looking at these sorts of things, but again, oftentimes with unexpected consequences. So you have to be very careful when you're doing that sort of work and do a lot of testing, across a lot of different species in order to make sure you don't have effects that you're not expecting.
Laura in Menominee Falls emailed and wonders, can she still trim her birch tree? She's read the correct trim is should be done late summer, early fall.
She's I think you should be okay to do pruning at this point. I'm oftentimes an advocate of winter pruning, although that can vary depending upon the species of trees. And that's strictly from a disease standpoint. Pathogens tend to be not active during the wintertime. So I think that's a better time to do a lot of different types of pruning. Not in all cases, but I think that should be fine. The main thing is to do it during a period when it's going to be dry and you don't have rain, because you want to have those pruning wounds seal off as quickly as possible. And you don't want it wet so that it's a good environment for disease-causing fungi to enter through the wounds.
And speaking of trimming, Robert wonders if he should trim back his current bushes in the this fall, or does he need to?
That's not necessarily a question I know that I can answer or not. My concern would be if you did it at this time of the year, you might prune off all of the flower buds for next year.
Yeah.
So that would be a concern. And I don't know specifically for currants when those flower buds form, but I'm assuming they do it in the late summer, early fall. And so, again, you could end up not having a fruit crop next year if you do it at the wrong time. But that would be, again, a question for someone else. I'm sorry, I just don't know the specifics on that particular plant.
I don't know if you have your computer up, but Bill in Chippewa Falls emailed a photo of a shrub and wanted to know how far back to trim it. I'm not sure. It looks like a...
Oh, it's a hydrangea.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not the best person to ask that particular question of. I tend to deal with pruning when we have diseased branches, but in terms of maintenance pruning, again, with the hydrangeas, it depends, I believe, on when they flower and the type of hydrangea, and I don't know the specifics on that particular. Where's the person from again?
Let's see, Chippewa Falls.
Chippewa Falls. Contact Margaret Murphy through the Chippewa County Extension Office. She's your local horticulture educator through the Extension Office, and she should be able to help you with how to prune those.
All right. And on that note, Brian, we're out of time. It was a busy show again. Thank you so
quickly today.
Yeah, it did fly. Well, I hope you'll be with us again. Look forward to hearing you and seeing you in person sometime.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Thanks, Brian. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, and we'll get him back. On Monday at 11, we talk about the latest in technology and troubleshoot your tech problems with our expert. So think about your computer and all your tech issues over the weekend. And a reminder, if you missed part of our show, want to hear it again, go to our archives at WPR.org/Larry, and you can hear this show and any other show going back for years. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.